Units 1. Passage 1.
We can read of things that happened 5,000 years ago in the Near East, where people first learned to write. But there are some parts of the world where even now people cannot write. The only way that they can preserve their history is to recount it as sagas, legends handed down from one generation of storytellers to another. These legends are useful because they can tell us something about migrations of people who lived long ago, but none could write down what they did. Anthropologists wondered where the remote ancestors of the Polynesian peoples now living in the Pacific Islands came from. The sagas of these people explain that some of them came from Indonesia about 2,000 years ago. But the first people who were like ourselves lived so long ago that even their sagas, if they had any, are forgotten. So, archaeologists have neither history nor legends to help them to find out where the first modern men came from. Fortunately, however, ancient men made tools of stone, especially flint, because this is easier to shape than other kinds. They may also have used wooden skins, but these have rotted away. Stone does not decay, and so the tools of long ago have remained when even the bones of the men who made them have disappeared without trace. Robin Place, Finding Fossil Man. Passage 2.
Why, you may wonder, should spiders be our friends? Because they destroy so many insects, and insects include some of the greatest enemies of the human race. Insects would make it impossible for us to live in the world. They would devour all our crops and kill our flocks and herds, if it were not for the protection we get from insect-eating animals. We owe a lot to the birds and beasts who eat insects, but all of them put together kill only a fraction of the number destroyed by spiders. Moreover, unlike some of the other insect eaters, spiders never do the least harm to us or our belongings. Spiders are not insects, as many people think, nor even nearly related to them. One can tell the difference almost at a glance, for a spider always has 8 legs, and an insect never more than 6. How many spiders are engaged in this work on our behalf? One authority on spiders made a census of the spiders in a grass field in the south of England, and he estimated that there were more than 2,250,000 in 1 acre. That is something like 6 million spiders of different kinds on a football pitch. Spiders are busy for at least half the year in killing insects. It is impossible to make more than the wildest guess at how many they kill, but they are hungry creatures, not content with only 3 meals a day. It has been estimated that the weight of all the insects destroyed by spiders in Britain in 1 year would be greater than the total weight of all the human beings in the country. T.H. Gillespie, Spare That Spider, from The Listener. Passage 3.
Modern alpinists try to climb mountains by a route which will give them good sport, and the more difficult it is, the more highly it is regarded. In the pioneering days, however, this was not the case at all. The early climbers were looking for the easiest way to the top, because the summit was the prize they sought, especially if it had never been attained before. It's true that during their explorations they often faced difficulties and dangers of the most perilous nature, equipped in a manner which would make a modern climber shudder at the thought. But they did not go out of their way to court such excitement. They had a single aim, a solitary goal, the top. It's hard for us to realize nowadays how difficult it was for the pioneers. Except for one or two places such as Zermatt and Chamonix, which had rapidly become popular, alpine villages tended to be impoverished settlements cut off from civilization by the high mountains. Such inns as there were generally dirty and flea-ridden, the food simply local cheese accompanied by bread, often 12 months old, all washed down with coarse wine. Often a valley boasted no inn at all, and climbers found shelter wherever they could, sometimes with the local priest, who was usually as poor as his parishioners. Sometimes with the local priest, who was usually as poor as his parishioners, sometimes with shepherds or cheesemakers. Invariably, the background was the same, debt and poverty, and very uncomfortable. For men accustomed to eating seven-course dinners and sleeping between fine linen sheets at home, a change to the Alps must have been very hard indeed. Walter Unsworth, Matterhorn Man. Passage 4.
In the Soviet Union, several cases have been reported recently of people who can read and detect colors with their fingers, and even see through solid doors and walls. One case concerns an 11-year-old schoolgirl, Vera Petrova, who has normal vision, but who can also perceive things with different parts of her skin and through solid walls. This ability was first noticed by her father. One day, she came into his office and happened to put her hands on the door of a locked safe. Suddenly, she asked her father why he kept so many old newspapers locked away there, and even described the way they were done up in bundles. Vera's curious talent was brought to the notice of a scientific research institute in the town of Ulyanovsk, near where she lives, and in April she was given a series of tests by a special commission of the Ministry of Health of the Russian Federal Republic. During these tests, she was able to read a newspaper through an opaque screen, and, stranger still, by moving her elbow over a child's game of lotto, she was able to describe the figures and colors printed on it. And, in another instance, wearing stockings and slippers, to make out with her foot the outlines and colors of a picture hidden under a carpet. Other experiments showed that her knees and shoulders had a similar sensitivity. During all these tests, Vera was blindfold, and, indeed, except when blindfold, she lacked the ability to perceive things with her skin. It was also found that although she could perceive things with her fingers, this ability ceased the moment her hands were wet. Eric de Morny, Seeing Hands, from The Listener. Passage 5.
The gorilla is something of a paradox in the African scene. One thinks one knows him very well. For 100 years or more, he's been killed, captured, and imprisoned in zoos. His bones have been mounted in natural history museums everywhere, and he has always exerted a strong fascination upon scientists and romantics alike. He is the stereotyped monster of the horror films and the adventure books, and an obvious, though not perhaps strictly scientific, link with our ancestral past. Yet the fact is, we know very little about gorillas. No really satisfactory photograph has ever been taken of one in a wild state. No zoologist, however intrepid, has been able to keep the animal under close and constant observation in the dark jungles in which he lives. Carl Akeley, the American naturalist, led 2 expeditions in the 1920s, and now lies buried amongst the animals he loved so well. But even he was unable to discover how long the gorilla lives, or how or why it dies. Nor was he able to define the exact social patterns of the family groups, or indicate the final extent of their intelligence. All this and many other things remain almost as much a mystery as they were when the French explorer Du Chaillu first described the animal to the civilized world a century ago. The abominable snowman who haunts the imagination of climbers in the Himalayas is hardly more elusive. Alan Moorhead, No Room in the Ark. Passage 6.
People are always talking about the problem of youth. If there is one, which I take leave to doubt, then it is older people who create it, not the young themselves. Let us get down to fundamentals and agree that the young are, after all, human beings, people just like their elders. There is only one difference between an old man and a young one. The young man has a glorious future before him, and the old one has a splendid future behind him, and maybe that is where the rub is. When I was a teenager, I felt that I was just young and uncertain, that I was a new boy in a huge school, and I would have been very pleased to be regarded as something so interesting as a problem. For one thing, being a problem gives you a certain identity, And that is one of the things the young are busily engaged in seeking. I find young people exciting. They have an air of freedom, and they have not a dreary commitment to mean ambitions or love of comfort. They are not anxious social climbers, and they have no devotion to material things. All this seems to me to link them with life and the origin of things. It's as if they were, in some sense, cosmic beings in violent and lovely contrast with us suburban creatures. All that is in my mind when I meet a young person. He may be conceited, ill-mannered, presumptuous, or fatuous, but I do not turn for protection to dreary clichés about respect for elders, as if mere age were a reason for respect. I accept that we are equals, and I will argue with him as an equal if I think he is wrong. Fielden Hughes, from Out of the Air, The Listener. Passage 7.
I'm always amazed when I hear people saying that sport creates goodwill between the nations, and that if only the common peoples of the world could meet one another at football or cricket, they would have no inclination to meet on the battlefield. Even if one didn't know from concrete examples, the 1936 Olympic Games, for instance, that international sporting contests lead to orgies of hatred, one could deduce it from general principles. Nearly all the sports practiced nowadays are competitive. You play to win, and a game has little meaning unless you do your utmost to win. On the village green, where you pick up sides and no feeling of local patriotism is involved, it's possible to play simply for the fun and the exercise. But as soon as the question of prestige arises, as soon as you feel that you and some larger unit will be disgraced if you lose, the most savage combative instincts are aroused. Anyone who's played even in a school football match knows this. At the international level, sport is frankly mimic warfare. But the significant thing is not the behavior of the players, but the attitude of the spectators. And, behind the spectators, of the nations who work themselves into furies over these absurd contests and seriously believe, at any rate for short periods, that running, jumping, and kicking a ball are tests of national virtue. George Orwell, The Sporting Spirit. Passage 8.
Parents have to do much less for their children today than they used to do, and home has become much less of a workshop. Clothes can be bought ready-made. Washing can go to the laundry. Food can be bought cooked, canned, or preserved. Bread is baked and delivered by the baker. Milk arrives on the doorstep. Meals can be had at the restaurant, the works canteen, and the school dining room. It is unusual now for father to pursue his trade or other employment at home, and his children rarely, if ever, see him at his place of work. Boys are therefore seldom trained to follow their father's occupation, and in many towns they have a fairly wide choice of employment, and so do girls. The young wage earner often earns good money, and soon acquires a feeling of economic independence. In textile areas, it has long been customary for mothers to go out to work, but this practice has become so widespread that the working mother is now a not unusual factor in a child's home life. The number of married women in employment having more than doubled in the last 25 years. With mother earning and his older children drawing substantial wages, father is seldom the dominant figure that he still was at the beginning of the century. When mother works, economic advantages accrue, but children lose something of great value if mother's employment prevents her from being home to greet them when they return from school. W. O. Lester Smith, Education. Passage 9.
Not all sounds made by animals serve as language, and we've only to turn to the extraordinary discovery of echolocation in bats to see a case in which the voice plays a strictly utilitarian role. To get a full appreciation of what this means, we must turn first to some recent human inventions. Everyone knows that if he shouts in the vicinity of a wall or a mountainside, an echo will come back. The further off this solid obstruction, the longer time will elapse for the return of the echo.
A sound made by tapping on the hull of a ship will be reflected from the sea bottom, and by measuring the time interval between the taps and the receipt of the echoes, the depth of the sea at that point can be calculated. So was born the echo-sounding apparatus, and now in general use in ships. Every solid object will reflect a sound, varying according to the size and nature of the object. A shoal of fish will do this. So it is a comparatively simple step from locating the sea bottom to locating a shoal of fish. With experience and with improved apparatus, it's now possible not only to locate a shoal, but to tell if it is herring, cod, or other well-known fish by the pattern of its echo. A few years ago, it was found that certain bats emit squeaks, and by receiving the echoes, they could locate and steer clear of obstacles,
or locate flying insects on which they feed.
This echolocation in bats is often compared with radar, the principle of which is similar. Passage 10.
In our new society, there is a growing dislike of original creative men. The manipulated do not understand them. The manipulators fear them. The tidy committee men regard them with horror, knowing that no pigeonholes can be found for them. We could do with a few original creative men in our political life, if only to create some enthusiasm, release some energy. But where are they? We are asked to choose between various shades of the negative. The engine is falling to pieces, while the joint owners of the car argue whether the foot brake or the handbrake should be applied. Notice how the cold, colourless men, without ideas and with no other passion but a craving for success, get on in this society, capturing one plum after another and taking the juice and taste out of them. Sometimes you might think the machines we worship make all the chief appointments, promoting the human beings who seem closest to them. Between midnight and dawn, when sleep will not come and all the old wounds begin to ache, I often have a nightmare vision of a future world in which there are billions of people, all numbered and registered, with not a gleam of genius anywhere, not an original mind, a rich personality, on the whole packed globe. The twin ideals of our time, organization and quantity, will have won forever. J.B. Priestley, Thoughts in the Wilderness. Unit 2, Passage 11.
Alfred the Great acted as his own spy, visiting Danish camps disguised as a minstrel. In those days, wandering minstrels were welcome everywhere. They were not fighting men, and their harp was their passport. Alfred had learned many of their ballads in his youth, and could vary his program with acrobatic tricks and simple conjuring. While Alfred's little army slowly began to gather at Athelney, the king himself set out to penetrate the camp of Guthrum, the commander of the Danish invaders.
These had settled down for the winter at Chippenham. Thither Alfred went. He noticed at once their discipline was slack. The Danes had the self-confidence of conquerors, and their security precautions were casual. They lived well on the proceeds of raids on neighbouring regions. There they collected women as well as food and drink, and a life of ease had made them soft. Alfred stayed in the camp a week before he returned to Athelney. The force there assembled was trivial compared with the Danish horde. But Alfred had deduced that the Danes were no longer fit for prolonged battle, and that their commissariat had no organisation, but depended on irregular raids. So faced with the Danish advance, Alfred did not risk open battle, but harried the enemy. He was constantly on the move, drawing the Danes after him. His patrols halted the raiding parties. Hunger assailed the Danish army. Now Alfred began a long series of skirmishes, and within a month the Danes had surrendered. The episode could reasonably serve as a unique epic of royal espionage. Bernard Newman, Spies in Britain. Passage 12.
What characterizes almost all Hollywood pictures is their inner emptiness. This is compensated for by an outer impressiveness. Such impressiveness usually takes the form of a truly grandiose realism. Nothing is spared to make the setting, the costumes,
all of the surface details correct. These efforts help to mask the essential emptiness of the characterization and the absurdities and trivialities of the plots. The houses look like houses. The streets look like streets. The people look and talk like people. But they are empty of humanity, credibility, and motivation. Needless to say, the disgraceful censorship code is an important factor in predetermining the content of these pictures. But the code does not disturb the profits, nor the entertainment value of the films. It merely helps to prevent them from being credible. It isn't too heavy a burden for the industry to bear. In addition to the impressiveness of the settings, there is a use of the camera, which at times seems magical. But of what human import is all this skill, all this effort, all this energy in the production of effects, when the story, the representation of life, is hollow, stupid, banal, childish? James T. Farrell, The Language of Hollywood. Passage 13.
Oxford has been ruined by the motor industry. The peace which Oxford once knew, and which a great university city should always have, has been swept ruthlessly away. And no benefactions and research endowments can make up for the change in character which the city has suffered. At 6 in the morning, the old court shake to the roar of buses taking the next shift to Cowley, and press-steel great lorries with a double-deck cargo of cars for export lumber past Magdalen and the University Church. Loads of motor engines are hurried hither and thither, and the streets are thronged with a population which has no interest in learning and knows no studies beyond servo systems and distributors, compression ratios and camshafts. Theoretically, the marriage of an old seat of learning and tradition with a new and wealthy industry might be expected to produce some interesting children. It might have been thought that the culture of the university would radiate out and transform the lives of the workers. That this has not happened may be the fault of the university, for at both Oxford and Cambridge, the colleges tend to live in an era which is certainly not of the 20th century, and upon a planet which bears little resemblance to the war-torn Earth. Wherever the fault may lie, the fact remains that it is the theatre at Oxford and not at Cambridge which is on the verge of extinction, and the only fruit of the combination of industry and the rarefied atmosphere of learning is the dust in the streets and a pathetic sense of being lost which hangs over some of the colleges. Roger Pilkington, Thames Waters. Passage 14.
Some old people are oppressed by the fear of death. In the young, there is a justification for this feeling. Young men who have reason to fear that they will be killed in battle may justifiably feel bitter in the thought that they have been cheated of the best things that life has to offer. But in an old man who has known human joys and sorrows and has achieved whatever work it was in him to do, the fear of death is somewhat abject and ignoble. The best way to overcome it, so at least it seems to me, is to make your interests gradually wider and more impersonal, until bit by bit the walls of the ego recede, and your life becomes increasingly immersed in the universal life. An individual human existence should be like a river, small at first, narrowly contained within its banks, and rushing passionately past boulders and over waterfalls. Gradually, the river grows wider, the banks recede, the waters flow more quietly, and in the end, without any visible break, they become merged in the sea and painlessly lose their individual being. The man who, in old age, can see his life in this way will not suffer from the fear of death, since the things he cares for will continue. And if, with the decay of vitality, weariness increases, the thought of rest will be not unwelcome. I should wish to die while still at work, knowing that others will carry on what I can no longer do, and content in the thought that what was possible has been done. Bertrand Russell, How to Grow Old, from Portraits from Memory. Passage 15.
When anyone opens a current account at a bank, he's lending the bank money, repayment of which he may demand at any time, either in cash or by drawing a check in favor of another person. Primarily, the banker-customer relationship is that of debtor and creditor. Who is which, depending on whether the customer's account is in credit or is overdrawn. But in addition to that basically simple concept, the bank and its customer owe a large number of obligations to one another. Many of these obligations can give rise to problems and complications, but a bank customer, and like, say, a buyer of goods, cannot complain that the law is loaded against him. The bank must obey its customer's instructions, and not those of anyone else. When, for example, a customer first opens an account, he instructs the bank to debit his account only in respect of checks drawn by himself. He gives the bank specimens of his signature, and there's a very firm rule that the bank has no right or authority to pay out a customer's money on a check on which its customer's signature has been forged. It makes no difference that the forgery may have been a very skillful one. The bank must recognize its customer's signature. For this reason, there is no risk to the customer in the modern practice adopted by some banks of printing the customer's name on his checks. If this facilitates forgery, it is the bank which will lose, not the customer. Gordon Barry and Aubrey L. Diamond, The Consumer Society and the Law.